let's take it from you. You moved to Wyndham, and you had said you were fairly warmly received. I had been talking about...
Right.
I had been talking about you being from the South and so forth, but, you know, having some Southern mannerisms, and you said that people there in Wyndham received you...
quite well.
Quite well. We didn't talk too much in details about, and maybe there isn't many details to tell, but I think you said you, when you first moved there, did you, you moved into the little house on the hill?
Was no, that? When I first moved there, I moved in with this old woman. Weiser was her name.
Oh, that's right.
And we lived in this big old house, you know, with lots of, it was, you know, it was not grand, but it was a big old house, and her husband had been the doctor in the town, and she was impossible and tried to get me to pay a bill that she had.
Oh, that's right.
Right, and
okay.
Really, right. An impossible old woman had a daughter that was, they were chintzy and tight, and but, you know, it was okay. And we lived across the street from the Henrys, and then I met Phyllis Hoffman, and so they became very good friends. And then there were a group of people there. The men had been in the war, and they had connections in Minnesota and in Wyndham, and they had come back after the war. And so we all had that much in common, and so it was okay. It was different from what it would have been for me had I lived in the South, but I don't know. It would require a little time to think about how different it was, but I feel very grateful that I didn't go back to the South, because I think I learned some really hard truths and some good things up here that I never would have learned in the South, because of racism and more elitist society, more separation into classes in the South than there was in this small town up here in Minnesota. I was raised with the idea that we were from the right side of the track, and that there were some people who were our kind and there were other people who were not our kind, and you associated with your own kind, and you were never rude or nasty to people who weren't your kind. But there was a big distinction, and that was kind of false too, because we were not elite then. But anyhow, that was the way I was raised. Yeah.
So you were in Wyndham, and you found you moved in with her, and then you found this little house, and that's you had Barbara already when you moved to Wyndham.
Yeah.
And then you had Melinda when you were living on the small house on the hill, or?
Yeah, I must have been, because we got that little house.
And this was the period when Walter was golfing and you were at home screaming and shouting.
Well, not exactly, but I wasn't very nice. But that was true always, he always golfed.
Right.
And it was okay, I mean, but because Melinda came so soon, you know, mm-hmm. and I didn't want her that soon, mm-hmm. We didn't have much money, and I looked ahead and I thought, we'll have eight kids, and Walter will still not be wanting to be just a, you know, nose to the grindstone person, and it's going to be left up to me, and I don't want to do it. That had never been my idea. And you know, you don't have long discussions with people when you get married. You, at least Walter and I did, and I don't think you do.
So you stayed home. You weren't working, obviously.
No.
Was a full-time mother.
Uh-huh.
And did you had Phyllis
and Dorothy.
Dorothy that you talked to on a regular basis? Did you?
Yeah, and the other people. And, you know, we talked a lot on the telephone. What I remember a lot was when I would once in a while get sick. And then I had these children, and there was nowhere to go. And you had the kids, and you were in the bed, and you couldn't take care of them. And then I learned to depend upon my friends. And that really made me understand in a real way our dependence upon one another, that I was truly dependent upon my friends, and that I did the same for them if they were sick. But I had never thought about that, how dependent we are upon one another in times like that.
So did they actually come over or bring food over?
Or I'd take they'd come pick up the kids or do something like that. Absolutely. So there was a real understanding. When I went to Wyndham, I'll talk about the church. I was raised Methodist, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to the Methodist church. And the Hillarys were Methodist. I think they were Methodist. And the sermons that I heard were against drinking, against card playing, against dancing, and a real puritanical approach to life. Well, I just thought, no, I can't do this. I can't go to church and listen to these kind of sermons. And yet I wanted to go to church. I felt I should. I don't know that I had any other inclination except I thought I should. And then I had friends who were Episcopalians, the Barnetts, Webb Barnett and his wife Mary. And they were our age, and I really liked them. And so I joined the Episcopal Church, a tiny little church. And the elite of Wyndham, if there could be an elite, went to that church. And I stayed in that church for a number of years. But more and more began to chafe, because it seemed to me that the litany, that the rituals of the church meant more to the people than living out the gospel. And by that time, what had happened? The Vietnam War hadn't started, but something was going on.
Let's see, when was Korea? No, that was before that.
Well, Korea happened while we were in Wyndham.
Okay.
Because your father had, I don't know that you know, you probably know this, but I'll tell you.
I think you told me.
Yeah, that he had taken up, he had the guard post in Wyndham so that we could pay our grocery bill.
Yeah.
But he had made this arrangement, and he had told him. The understanding was that if war were declared, he would not go, that would end his commitment. And we were just, I couldn't sleep the night before. He came up to the city, because when the Korean War was declared, then the guard was on the way to go. And he came up here, and they honored their agreement. But some of the women, I remember one woman whose son went, was furious with me over that. And I think I told you, Beverly Miller told me that people were mad about it. And I said, I know what I told her. I didn't usually use this kind of language. I said, I don't give a damn. I don't give a damn. So it must have been the Korean War, because I went with a group of church women, Episcopalian church women, were going to a diocesan meeting somewhere. And I rode with them. And so when we arrived at this little town where the meeting was being held, there was a program, and they were talking about pornographic and material literature and stuff. And I stood up in the church, and I said, I said that I had read something that I considered absolutely, did I use the word pornographic, but evil, and that it was an art or a column that said that the United States was using the blueprint for Korea to determine its foreign policy, and that we were going to use that policy from now on And that I considered that was just as evil as anything could be. And when we look at what's evil, that I would suggest that the church would look at the reality behind what was being said. And I sat down. I did not tell you this. So then when I was waiting in a big line to go to the bathroom, and the wife of the clergyman at this place said to me, you know, I understand exactly how you feel. She said, when I read those things in the paper, I just turn the page real quick so I don't have to look at it. And so then when we rode back with the women in the car, not one of them mentioned it to me. Now, I've had that happen in the past. I have, and my voice cracked. It cracked because I was very emotional. And I've had that in the past when I've done things like that. And it embarrasses people. They are humiliated for you that you have kind of put yourself out there, kind of like being naked in front of them all. You've exposed yourself, and one shouldn't do that. Not one woman spoke to me about what I said.
Now, this was in the middle of a church?
No, we were just going to this meeting. Now, the women were going to this women's meeting.
Okay. And
so we had driven down in the car to this little town where the meeting was being held.
Okay.
So this was on the way back.
Okay, got it.
And nobody talked to me. That's okay.
Yep.
So then I began thinking about it. And I was very unhappy about it. But now that I remember, I did not leave the church then. The other thing that bothered me was that they called me and wanted me to bring cookies and things to a church supper. And I said, no. I said, I don't cook enough. I don't make enough cookies for my own kids. And when I cook for my children. I don't want to do that. I don't want to cook. But I am a member of the church. But I don't want to do that.
Did you do anything else with the church?
Oh, yeah. I did. I think I did what I could. Then when we went to Marshall, Bill Green was the pastor there. And I told them when I came, I laid it out. I said, I want to be involved with the church, but I want to tell you, I'm not going to cook. I'm not going to be down here at church suppers. That's just what I'm not going to do. Well, I don't know what happened, but something happened. And it was made very clear to me that I had to. And so I got out of the church. And they were so angry at me that when your father ran for judge, there were several thousand votes against him. And I knew where they came from. Those people were mad at me. And so they took it out on water and so forth. But anyhow. So and your dad was going to the Catholic Church, and I could not stand what the Catholic Church.
We're back in Wyndham?
No, but that was in, that he went both places.
Right.
And took you all to church.
Right.
And it was never really any item of contention between us. I didn't care, but I wasn't going
to
do it.
So you never went to the Catholic Church in Wyndham?
No.
Never?
Mm-hmm. Maybe once or twice when you were being confirmed.
Okay.
But I didn't, because there was so much that I knew what the church was, that what it stood for, and the priest was very much a part of the family. The women, I would hear the women talk, I've got to go talk to Father so-and-so about this, about things that involved them, and I felt this was, I was not going to go to the priest. I was not going to do that. So I didn't, I'm going to really digress here and say, you asked me about being pregnant, if I didn't have any thoughts about the last time we talked about the birth of your children.
Oh.
And I want to say that the one I do remember was yours.
Mm.
Because I was so excited that we had a little boy.
Mm.
I think I've told you that.
Yeah.
That they gave me sleeping pills and I slept. I couldn't sleep. I was awake all night long. Mm. And Connie and Barbara and Melinda were so excited too, they just couldn't wait. So anyhow, that I remember. But now, going back to Wyndham and the church.
So you never went to the Catholic Church except when somebody was being confirmed or something, when Barbara and it wasn't a point of, but Walter was in the choir.
Yes.
And he never asked you to go or...
No, No.
But now, you had said before that it was sometime in Wyndham when you, I'll say again because you were exposed to it as a child, you read some scriptures of the teachings of Christ.
Yes, it was in Wyndham. It was 1952.
So tell me about that.
Well, that was...
How did that come about? How did you...
It was really interesting. I think it's interesting. Of course, you know, we're all so self-centered. I knew that I didn't believe in killing. I knew that. I mean, I just... I knew after watching it and looking at the war, I just knew I didn't believe in it. And I read in something I was taking, the Nation or something, it had comments, people had commented on this Quaker tract, Speak Truth to Power. So I thought that sounds so interesting, so I sent for it. I have copies here, I'll give you one. And I read it once, and it was like the light came on. And it wasn't anything except it was a lot, of course. It was saying that the teachings of Christ had to be literally interpreted. That when Christ said, you shall not kill anybody, that's what was meant. That you should love your enemies. You should walk the second mile. Blah, 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 blah. And it was so gorgeous. So I read it to your father. I read portions of it. I said, because he was practicing law then. We built the house on the hill, and he was doing pretty well. You know, money was always tight, but he was doing pretty well. And I said, you know, I'm going to talk about this. But if I do, people are going to say I'm crazy. I've told you this.
Not this part.
No. And so he said, the world needs more crazy people like you. Mm. And he never... ever stopped me, ever said one word to me about anything that I did. The fact is, he would egg me on sometimes to do more and more. So that I just couldn't have done it without that. I just, having that really firm support there, and that meant so much to me. It was wonderful. It was just like one time I said something very hateful to him. And I said, you know, I'm sorry. And I said that. He said, I knew when you said it, you didn't mean it. And I forgave it to you. I forgave you when you said it. And that kind of a generosity of spirit he really had. Mm-hmm. And that was with us always. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I say to you today, I would do it again. Mm-hmm. I would marry him again. Mm-hmm. Because it being with him, I had the freedom to be who I was and to have my children whom I loved, and yet to do and say what I felt was right and just. And so that was, and I think I gave him that freedom. I did, except for golf. So he pretty much had, because otherwise if I did, you know, I would have had him working longer hours, and he would have been at judges' conferences and probably would have been on the circuit court and so forth instead of staying. But he had no ambitions beyond the district court. He said he didn't care. He did. That was as far as he wanted to go.
Let's talk a little bit more about this Quaker tract.
Uh-huh.
You read it, and it said the teachings of Christ should be taken literally.
Exactly.
And you obviously never heard that expressed any way remotely close.
Well, I
never.
That's interesting. See, yes, I had. I'd been raised on all that stuff. I'd been to Methodist Sunday school. I'd been to Sunday school every Sunday from the time I was a little girl, up until junior high at least. And I had books. Books, religious books that were put out for children. But the difference is, in my family, there was no discussion of that, and it was not really believed. I mean, there was no discussion ever of in applying. And maybe there isn't in most families, but nevertheless, there was never any connection made between that and real life, walking the second mile. Or I'll give you an example. My mother said, well, I can still remember it, and something about something that I complained about somebody that done something to me. And she said, you got to give it back to them. The way they gave it to you, only give it back to them twice as hard. Give it back to them. And she believed that. And that's a direct, that's directly in opposition to what Christ would say.
Right.
And so, but that, because I thought later, why did I on one reading, it was one reading and I believed every word in that tract, why did I believe it? And it was because I've been raised with it and it had entered my head. But the manifestations of it had not appeared to me. And so then I did talk about it. I would ask for speaking engagements and I would talk about it in Wyndham. No, this was in Marshall. I can remember the first time I did it. I don't know how. I'd say I have a subject, you know, you want a program? I want to talk about this track. And as soon as I got finished, the women could not wait to talk about where they'd been and what their recipes were. And there was no discussion of the track. And that went on and went on. No discussion of what I said. And so I thought, there's something wrong here that I'm not making any headway. And so then I decided that I had to talk about self-interest. That I had to talk and show people how it was to their self-interest to believe in that. That it worked well for them, that they would do better, and not the spiritual blessings that went along with it, but rather the material. And I did that. And I kept trying for numbers of years to talk about, when I'd talk to groups, about how it would be better economically. War is so foolish. We spend so much money on war that we should, it's economically not feasible to really win this way. But then later I realized that I was right the first time. People just have to look at it for what it is. I think that the political parties, that's how the Republicans, they do use that. I mean, the people on the right now use it and give it to you. And I think that's okay. I think it's okay. And I do, more than I used to. I do. I will say, I believe in the message of Christ, that you shouldn't kill one another. And so, it's really kind of interesting with this Every Church a Peace Church that the mainline churches, that the people from the historic peace churches are trying to introduce this concept to the mainline churches and get them to accept it so that we can declare war illegal. But it requires, it's almost hopeless, because it requires a conversion of the society in which we abandon our emphasis on getting rich. Mm. I mean, that's the thing that keeps us from it, obsession with money and being safe ourselves, and me and my mind. Well, you know that.
Yeah.
So, but anyhow, I've gotten way off on this.
That's right. When you talk about the tract and kind of a light bulb coming on.
Yeah.
And then you're comparing it to how you were raised and so forth. If we were to say the message of Christ obviously is about a love.
Right.
A powerful, pure kind of love.
Right.
So somehow I'm guessing that there's an aspect of that love that was missing from your home, or that track, when you read it, the light bulb already would have been on, or not necessarily? I'm just fishing a little bit.
I don't know. I guess, I don't think you can be real racist and believe the message of Christ. If you're a racist, then it's only the white people. It's only certain people that are children of God. The others are lesser children of God. So I think racism really keeps us from looking at that. And it does. And it's so involved, you know, and you keep trying to understand it. Last night I was at a couple of nights ago at this meeting, and people that believe the same way, and this friend of mine who's always contentious, and I like him, but he was talking about how he had been talking to Bishop Erdahl, and Erdahl says one shouldn't kill each other, and this man said, well, what about the police? And Erdahl said, well, I don't think we should have a police force. Well, this man said, so how do I can't go along with that. He doesn't want a police force. And if he was really believing in nonviolence, there would be no police. So then we got into the discussion about you never are static in anything, or it's dead. So if you believe something, you're constantly examining and questioning the aspects of it that are important to you. Mm-hmm. And so that's the same that it made me think about. You know, I'm not an anarchist. I believe there have to be controls in the society, but you continually question. And I'm very critical. I'm very critical of everything. And I it's not that I want to be critical, but I reflect on everything. Mm-hmm. That's probably why I have trouble sleeping sometimes.
Do you think, now you read this tract in Wyndham?
I read it in Marshall.
You read it in Marshall. Okay.
1952.
Well, we didn't move till 55. Or 54. We moved the fall of 54.
No, I read this in Wyndham. Did I say Marshall?
Yeah.
52. It was in Wyndham.
Okay.
It was in Wyndham.
In Wyndham. Didn't start speaking about it till you got to Marshall.
No, I started speaking about it in Wyndham.
Oh, you did?
Mm-hmm.
Like ladies' luncheons?
Yeah. Things like that. Church.
And not well received.
Not well received, no.
Would they applaud or at all?
Oh, they would be. Well, Minnesota's very...
Minnesota nice, as they say.
Very nice, and they'd say that's really interesting.
Do you think that, and maybe this is, and I'll have to look at the track, but would it be fair to say that when you read it, you applied it in one direction? Like, you know, okay, we shouldn't be in war. I mean, you could, and maybe that's how the tract was worded, but...
Oh, you mean not applied?
In terms of...
A personality, you mean in terms of my personal life?
Personal relationships.
Okay.
Or
no, I think you're right that my concentration was on war because I saw that as the main evil, and I guess I still do. And why I do, but I knew that you really can't. I couldn't, in honesty, pursue the one course without realizing that I had to continually examine myself for my warlike attitudes, and I fall very short in that, and I know that I do. But I do. I agree with you. My problem with the other aspect is that so many people get hung up on personal salvation that they never get to the other point.
Mm-hmm.
That it's me and mine and saving myself,
right.
and not worrying about the others. And so
right.
That's it. But it is part of the whole. And
one more question, then we'll move on about that moment.
Yeah.
So you saw it as a... Would it be fair to say an intellectual enlightenment? Would that be a correct way of saying it? In other words, you didn't get from any personal sense of, I'll say, release or a new or deeper beliefs per se. It was more. Here's an answer to something that's been bothering me for a long time.
Well, that was it. But I do believe with Gandhi that it's more than a strategy. It's not a strategy. It has to be an occupation of the whole self. That I fall short in it when it comes to me and my personal relationships is one of those things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Not to make me satisfied in that,
right.
But I see the greater, for me, the greater problem is the fact that so many millions of people die in war. I went to Camelot last night, and I didn't realize it, but that was even part of that little part of the play.
Okay.
Is the king, Arthur, and it was interesting. Arthur in the play is saying that law has to take the place of war, that's part of the storyline of the play. And it could have been improved upon. I don't think it's a great play in terms of plot, but the music was so gorgeous that I could see it again and again. So,
all right. So let's go back to Wyndham, and you. What? Why did you decide to build a new house?
Oh, well, that was vanity. Well, we were crowded in that little house.
But you could have bought an existing house.
Oh, no, exactly. I could have. And we should have. We should have. But I wanted a house on the river, and I wanted a modern house, and I didn't want any of those other houses. And your dad should have said no to me, but he didn't.
Talk a little bit. I remember something in conversation years ago with you about the building of that house and the
contract. We had a terrible time. The contractor upped the price, and it was, and he got the level of it wrong, and it was a disaster. But we did it, and then we got ready to sell it. Nobody wanted to buy it, and so it was my pride. I wanted that nice house. And
now, when I was growing up in that house, it absolutely appeared gigantic. And then when Barbara and I, you know, went in, you know, a number of years ago, it was a very small house.
I guess it wasn't big at all.
Isn't that funny?
I know.
It was very small.
Yeah.
By today's standards.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But you found the designer, you designed it?
No, we had an architect. It was architect design.
Okay, an architect.
I had seen this architect, Frost was his name, and he had designed a hospital or something that I'd seen. It was very modern, very stark, and I just liked it. And so we went back to him, and he designed it.
Okay.
So we paid for an architect's. And the first plan he came out with was bigger. We couldn't afford that. So he drew the smaller plan. And, we should never have done that. I shouldn't have done that.
Okay, so, let's see. Then Connie would have been born in 1951,
52. You know, my
sometime around the time you moved into, no, you had already, how many years did we live in that house? You didn't live in that house real long.
No, because we moved to Marshall in 60. So about 8 years.
Okay. What do you remember about Connie's birth or Connie's anything?
No.
Okay,
trying to
go chronological here. And then we talked a little bit about my birth. So as you had two, then three, then four children, still going through your mind was, I'm going to have eight, and
yeah, right.
Arthur doesn't believe in birth control, and this is going to be a problem.
Right, right.
And and then you read that tract, and in Wyndham started talking to people, and Walter was encouraging.
Yes, yes. He was.
Still played a lot of golf.
Still played a lot of golf, yeah.
And
you know, not only that, but in Wyndham, the men would play bridge. And in the evening sometime, The men would go out and leave the wives at home and play bridge. Just the men. And if you don't think that galled me, that really galled me, that they would go and play golf and leave me, who'd been at home all day with the kids, home alone again. I was not nice about it.
Now, we had some visitors from Japan at that house. Two men.
Oh, no, they were from Vietnam.
Vietnam.
I've got pictures of them, Van Van Day.
Okay. It comes up on that. That's right. So how is it you knew them?
I don't remember now. It must have been through the friends somehow. Because I got involved through the friends.
Okay.
The American Friends Service Committee. In fact, I met a man named Leonard Tinker from...
Name sounds familiar.
Yeah, from... Iowa, from... Sioux City, Des Moines. They have an office of the American Friends. He was actually a Methodist minister. And we kept in contact, and he'd write me things about what's going on. In fact, he told me long before the Vietnam War started that what was going to happen. He said that was for me to watch for it, because that was what was going to happen. So Van Van Day had been, the United States was involved in Vietnam and was paying for the cost before when the French got out, we assumed all the obligations of the French in Vietnam, and we were paying for that, and the American people did not know that. We were
paying for
the cost of the war against the Viet Cong, against the so-called communist Vietnamese. And so where was it going with that? So Van Day would have been on our side, on the American side, and he had been the principal of a vocational school in, I think, Saigon. And he and his friend came to this country, and I think they were learning English. And they spent several weekends with us. I've forgotten where they were living, and what they were doing. But then he brought me the copy of the Constitution that was done by Ho Chi Minh, that was copied after our Constitution.
Oh.
And I have a picture of him someplace. And I suspect he's dead now. I suspect he's dead. But they were lovely. And I wrote a poem about sitting at the dining room table in Marshall with him one time, and he looked out the window, and he's a little mad, and he said, in America, even the sparrows are fat. And so then I asked him, I said, have you eaten sparrows? And he said, yes.
Now, again, how did he meet you? Why did he come to our house? It was through the friends?
I think it was through the friends somehow.
And they were just visiting this country?
Yes, yes.
And they where did they live in Vietnam? Were they from the north? Or?
They would have had to have been from the south.
South.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. They would have had to have been from the south.
And when they visited you the first time, the war hadn't...
There was no war. Well, there was a war. It was not a fighting war, and the United States had not sent troops there.
Yeah.
That was to happen later. Yeah.
Anything else about the Henrys or the Hoffmans or life in Wyndham, the town square, the courthouse, the movie theater, the golf course, there's a bowling alley, there's the church.
Well, across the street from us lived the, what was her name, Joe? Handovitz. I don't know if you remember that, but when we lived up, where were they? Because Sophie and Hans became friends of ours, and he drove. He was a buyer of a cattle buyer, and they had a big. He had a big truck, and he went out and bought cattle, and they had a daughter named Joyce, and they just became very good friends, and so they remained friends for years, and I think they're both dead, but their daughter Joyce still lives in Wyndham, and I see her once in a while. And then in Wyndham we had a friend called Carl Schneider, who was the manager of the flax plant there. And he now lives here, and he I'm sure they paid him off in stocks and all that kind of stuff. And he became very wealthy, and I do see his once in, well, actually his he had a birthday, and his wife Dory, whom I knew, got in touch with me up here, and they sent a car for me and drove me, because it was out Minnetonka someplace out there, and I was present at their birthday party. And one of his daughters is a composer who's nationally known. One of his daughter is a lawyer, and one is an architect. Now tell me, how does that happen? I just don't know, because these, I mean, it's just, you know, those are the prestigious jobs, and on the outside it looks like, but you know that's not the case. You know what I mean?
Not exactly, but...
Well, what I mean is, it looks like everything went according to the plan. These were wealthy people they would want their kids to achieve.
Oh, I see.
And so, but we never know what's under there. I mean, I don't know.
Uh-huh.
I don't know.
And then there was the, let's see, Walter was friends with somebody that worked at the Toro plant.
Oh, yeah.
I even remember the house that they, right on the corner as you pulled into Rolling Green there, on the left. Can't think of his name.
Well, but yes, that's true, yeah.
And the people across the street, the other way, I think, from our house, was at Walter's funeral. Who were they? He was there, or his daughter was there, and maybe his wife.
Oh, the Oslins.
Oslins.
Oh, yes, they lived down the street from us.
Yeah, tell it to
Well, Wes, yeah, Wes worked for, yeah, he did work for, I think, Toro. Yeah, and they had two or three kids, and they played with our kids, and we were just good friends. they once, oh, this is funny, he was a hunter. Your dad was never a hunter. And we had a dog. You remember our dog? The big, we had a Springer Spaniel. And Wes had gone hunting and had hung up some pheasants in his garage. And one day we looked out the door, and here comes a Springer Spaniel with one of those pheasants in his mouth. He had been in the garage, and he brought a pheasant to us. And we called Wes, and he said, well, that's a fine way to, he said, I was going to give you one, but since you've already gotten it, that's okay. So Wes, and I've seen Wes and Jane since then, and they were good friends. We had good friends, and there were another couple there. What was their name? Oh, gee. There were a lot of good friends in Marshall.
Now, I remember the one, because we have a picture of it somewhere when we, oh, I don't know if you went with, I think you did. We all went for a hike along the river there, and it rained when we were out on our hike, and we came back, and somebody snapped a picture, and we were all soaked. I think Marcella was with us even. Maybe she took the picture. But do you have any recollection before we leave Wyndham of, did you didn't have any money for any vacations or anything
no.
like that?
No. So what did we do?
I remember you telling me, I think you told me this, that, and I know this happened in Marshall, maybe it started in Wyndham, that for Christmas, Walter would get to take the Dayton's credit card and go up to Minneapolis.
And just buy like crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yes, that was true. And we were in Marshall, I think, when we took the trip to Estes Park, the vacation. Were you there?
No, I wasn't there.
Maybe you weren't born then, because we had...
Oh, that was from Wyndham.
We had a vacation in Estes Park.
Yeah.
The Henrys had been there, and they told us about it. They had a big family camp out there. And it was a wonderful vacation because they had a program for the children. They had a day camp for the children, and then the parents could do what they wanted to do. And then another time, still in Wyndham, we took a vacation to the Black Hills, and Beverly Miller had been a babysitter, and she lived just down the corner from us. Her father was a town drunk, and I don't know how they made a living. Oh, well, he did odd jobs, and she had told us about this. I don't know how they knew it, about this house. It had no running water or anything, but it was lovely in the Black Hills, and that was a great vacation. You probably weren't along on that one either, but Beverly just died. She was she came up here. She went to Augustana in Sioux Falls to college, and then she married somebody there, and I never saw her.
You brought her up in conjunction with the trip. You didn't take her with you?
No. But she did a lot of babysitting. Then the other person who babysat with you was a woman named Iris, who lived next door, and her husband worked for the city, cleaning the streets and everything else. And she had lost a leg, and they lived pretty, you know, poor. And so she did a lot of babysitting. I know I took advantage of her. I paid her, but I think she did it when she probably didn't want to.
I also remember a man that...
Leif Hofstede.
Yeah.
And Leif was a very good friend. Leif was a very good friend. He had
repaired clock.
He had epilepsy.
Okay.
And he was very lonely. And he was just a very good friend. He was more my friend than Walter's. But he was somewhat bitter about having epilepsy. At that time, he couldn't drive a car, and I don't think you could get married. He was telling me about one of his friends got sick and had a stroke. And he said, I told him, now you know what it's like. So, but he was, and I do hear from, he had a niece named Mildred Ingebo, and I do hear from her yet. And that were very Norwegian family, very strong roots in Norway. And Mildred, who was the niece and lives in North Dakota, I've been in touch with her from time to time.
There's also the chiropractor?
Teagles.
Teagles. And also a man and a wife that lived near where the Teagles lived. They were Malone or?
Oh, Evelyn Malone.
Yeah.
Evelyn Malone was a very good friend of mine. And Pat was her husband. And I liked her, a very selfish woman. And it's funny how you like people and you know that. I knew that about her. And we took a trip to Arkansas one time, she and Pat and Walter and I. And she was good company, I know that. And she's very intelligent, and I enjoyed her. They had a new car, and we had an old car. And I thought for sure that they would take their car. She told us no. We're not taking our car, she said. And I kind of, and then Pat, when we drove down, had a $100 bill. That was the only cash he had. Whenever we went into the service stations, nobody had cash for a $100 bill. She was a good friend. She has a niece, Ruby Silliman, that she left all her money to. Had a lot of money, she and Pat. And
let me ask you a question. This maybe is a fair question, maybe not.
Okay.
One could say, I suppose, perhaps from a distance, that as you've gotten older, your friendships have perhaps been somewhat guided by political beliefs.
Well, you say political. It's much more philosophical. Okay?
Okay.
It is political, but it's the philosophy behind the politics. Because okay. If it's just political, look at the Democrats.
Right, yeah, when I say political, I don't mean
necessary party.
Left versus right.
Oh, yeah. Now say that again then.
Well, I didn't finish what I was going to say, which was, we're talking about your friends in Wyndham.
Yeah.
Long before your politics, I think, were so well defined.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking that back then, probably you didn't consider in these friends that we just talked about and listed where they were politically. I mean, that wasn't on your radar screen.
No, but I was aware of it. I mean, it was not that I didn't know. For example, my friend Evelyn Malone was the one who really introduced me to the Democratic Party.
Okay.
And I would not have gotten involved in Democratic politics, which I was heavily involved in.
Yeah.
Because when I couldn't work, and I have, desires to do things, I don't know what it is, but that I had this energy to put to a good cause, and politics was there. And so she knew Hubert Humphrey and was a friend of Hubert Humphrey's. And so she said she introduced me to the Democratic Party. And I got involved in the Democratic Party through her. And
talk about that was in Wyndham, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was in Wyndham. And then her brother-in-law, Roland Muller, was a very close friend of Hubert Humphrey's. So that's how I met Humphrey, and met him when he was still mayor, before he became senator. And so I knew him from kind of the beginning. And I would say,
when you enjoyed these friends in Wyndham.
Yeah.
And most of the time, I'm going to assume that the conversations were not, did not even touch on politics or philosophy per se.
I wouldn't say that.
Okay.
I think that's
okay.
No,
correct me.
Then I would say that because I'm who I am.
Uh-huh.
I knew very well where most everybody stood politically, even then. Not as you said on the basis of Democrat or politics, but how they felt about world hunger, or how they felt about the poor, or how they felt about the way troops are being used. And so it wasn't that I isolated them, but it's true, few of them became close friends. That the Henrys, for example, were not Democrats. The Henrys were Republicans, but they philosophically, Russ and Dorothy were, I related to them, and so, but there were, and most of those people were there. Today I have few friends that are on the right.
I remember you first time you used this expression years ago, but the expression is a real conversation. So you would say probably that these friends in Wyndham, you did have many what you would call real conversations.
Yes, in which people say who they are and tell me something about, reveal something inside themselves. Yes, with those people, I did. And some of those people, I can remember some that I was less interested in than others.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you first, this another question comes to mind. When you first moved to Wyndham,
yeah.
That was in 1950.
Right after the war.
1950 or 1940?
Would have been in the 40s, because the war was over at when?
45.
45, it would have been a year after that, probably 46 or 40, 46.
Okay, so 46. And so you would have been 27?
Probably, yeah.
27. So, by today's standards, 27 is pretty young.
Yeah.
But it sounds like already your political convictions, even though you hadn't read that tract yet, it was like it had been brewing for some time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think so far in our conversations, we must have skipped a step.
Okay.
Because you talked about what happened at the base when you realized what was happening, that these soldiers were going out, their families were saying goodbye, some of them weren't coming back.
Yeah.
But other than that, you really haven't, I mean,
yeah.
One thing you said when you were young, you were an avid reader.
Yeah, I was.
And did you continue reading? And when was there time to read?
I read all my life, yeah. And I can't tell you what I read, but I read Thomas Merton. I read a lot of religious books about that time that I read Speak Truth to Power. I've got some of them here now, and Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and I read Purity of Heart is to Will One Thing. What is his name? He's a very famous religious thinker.
Purity of Heart is to Will One Thing.
Is to Will One Thing. And I remember reading that book, and it was hard reading. And because a man repeat himself. And the message is just to will one thing. Not because you want to go to heaven, not because of anything except that gives you a pure heart, is to will one thing, which is goodness, to will goodness, the oneness with God. And I know I read a bit of that stuff, but I read other things. I read novels. I read everything. So also in South America, as I told you, I did see abject poverty, and I met people who were very anti-U.S. And I did read about world hunger, and I hadn't really studied. Like if I had had a, I'm not sure what, Michael, because I know many people who graduated from college who don't end up.
They don't end up where you're at.
No, that's what I was going to say. Who don't have that kind of compulsion. I say I'm compulsive to learn. So I don't know. But.
And you as a young person, certainly, and that's not the only time, but you are very beautiful and very intelligent.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Right? That's a fair...
I never thought either. I never thought. I always felt that... I knew I was attractive, okay, but I didn't... I always felt lacking when it came to my education. Mm. Always felt that... Because I didn't go to college, I felt a little bit inferior about that. Mm. But
it was that, the intelligence, the desire to learn, the reading the books, the base, the war, the World War II, the poverty you saw, continuing to read, all of this is just kind of churning around inside.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would just read the track.
Yeah, it happened, and I don't know. And in a way, it's kind of a curse. At the same time, it's wonderful because it's you. Who was that? I had a conversation today. Because I was at this People of Faith, and we had what was a discussion about today. Because I reacted to it. We had they gave a reading of a play, which is about war. And we talked about, and one of the women, young women there said, she always liked to hear what I had to say. And somehow kids came up and I talked about children and I said, well, you know, my kids were exposed from an early age. And that has bad effects as well as good. You're exposed to the truth. you're exposed to, you knew about things that I never knew about until I was old. You knew about it because I didn't let you not know about it. You see, so that is, and I think, destructive, but I couldn't help it. I couldn't help that. I just am who I am. Mm-hmm. But you see, I grew up, and for years, you know, I can remember coming home from school when I was in high school, sitting down on the chaise longue with a banana and a book, and even though it was the Depression, life was good. I mean, I wasn't aware of
poverty or
no, I knew people were poor. Well, I was telling them, we discussed this today, people were dying at that time in Arkansas of starvation. They actually died. I was totally unaware of that. There was nothing in the newspapers about that. Those of us like me and my family, it was not there. And so you're kept in ignorance, but I think in a way that kind of gives you a little protection, that kind of, because then you're given a kind of a base. Whereas when you're brought up in a family as a child and you know from the beginning that there's much injustice in the world, it makes you, when you're still raw, you're kind of unsettled with it. And so that I know happened to you, and I think it happened to Melinda. And
say that again, what you just said about being unsettled.
I think it's unsettling to have all that information
before you're
kind of certain of who you are.
Uh-huh.
It's kind of thrown at you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's unsettling. That's the only word I can use now.
Well, I think just to go digress for a moment, I think young people today have it much tougher because they don't even need a parent who's, you know, how you were. I mean, they have Littleton color. They have, you know, high school murders.
I know.
They have a lot of things, and you know.
Well, actually, after having looked at it, I do think, and I think this is probably not true today because farms are almost a thing of the past. Corporations are farming now, but the farm families, I felt, were the kids who grew up on the farm really had it good.
Yeah.
Because they had their parents there. They went home from school and they learned from their parents who were usually pretty clear thinking.
Yeah.
I think that today, well, I'll digress a little bit. When I look at the television and I see especially the young girls, they all look the same, they talk the same. It's kind of sad to me. It's like there's not any differentiation between them, and the whole sexual thing, I don't think it's gotten any better. I think it's gotten worse. Instead of becoming more sure of themselves and not needing, I mean, I think girls should be able to grow up and think, well, so maybe I get married, maybe I don't. I've got things to accomplish, but that's not happened. And despite the women's movement, I mean, the women's movement has been a failure.
Right.
Really.
Yeah. Well, I don't disagree. In Wyndham.
Yeah. Okay.
Walter was playing golf.
Yeah.
But he was also in the Rotary. He was in the garden.
Oh yes.
He was doing all kinds of things.
Oh yes. Yes, he was. He was.
So, he wasn't home much at all.
Well, I never figured that. I mean, I don't think I felt sorry for myself because he wasn't home.
No, but you were angry about it, certainly when he was out on the golf course.
Oh, that in itself. Well, then when he played bridge in the nighttime, you go out
right,
with
and
his
men. And he went bowling, right?
And he bowled, and that's true. That's
yeah.
Probably, you know, I never thought about it. Probably I did at the time, and the years have just wiped it out. But he probably wasn't. Probably wasn't. And, you know, that was because I think that he didn't have any model. You know, his father before him was like that.
What you mean?
His father bowled all the time.
Okay.
And I remember, he wouldn't come home. He wouldn't come home. He was due for supper. He would be an hour or two late.
Yeah.
And his mother would be furious with him. And so it was one of those things.
So we're at the end of the Wyndham years, and you, Walter, as I recall, was upset because of what his experiences in the courtroom with judges that were not fair.
Yeah. Well, you know,
I mean, I remember him telling me one incident in particular.
Yes, and I think, as I told you, I think he spent, I bet it was 4 years before he had a winning case. He had probate cases, he had other cases, but he was never, and you can imagine he would not have been, a ruthless lawyer. And lawyers almost have to be ruthless.
And salesmen.
Yes, and ruthless in even if the course that they're pursuing is going to bring out the truth and is good, they really have to nail people. And that was not Walter's forte. He was not that way. And so I saw his being a judge as the way that he should go. And of course it was Humphrey, you know, who demanded that he make be. It was Humphrey who talked to Orville Freeman that got your father appointed judge.
And just for the record, how did that happen again?
Because of me.
So?
Because I had worked for Humphrey, okay, and had supported him, and had supported him in Wisconsin, and I actually represented him with Evelyn, my other friend, in Washington at a woman's meeting. And I had been the county chairwoman of the Democratic Party in Wyndham.
Okay.
And we had a really good, it was well organized party there. And it was really nice because I met farmers who were active, and it was a real relationship, and I got to know them. They were friends. So it was really a good experience. And so he did that because I asked him to.
Okay, before we go on to that then, let's just talk a minute longer. Tell me something else about your being active in the Democratic Party in Wyndham.
Okay.
Tell me more. You met these farmers, you had meetings, caucuses.
Oh, well, we'd meet once a month. We'd have meetings out in the country at, what did they call them? Town halls, county, yeah, they were town halls out in the country. And then we'd go out and there'd maybe be 8 or 10 people out there. There wouldn't be very many people. And then you would have a county convention, and that would be held every year or 2 years, I don't remember. Then you go from the county to the district, and then from the district to the state. And so you meet people at these various levels. And I just wrote an article for Eddie. He's not going to print it, but I didn't think he would. But anyhow, it was about, what was it about? Oh. It was about a book I had written. I read a book about LBJ when I was in California. Connie had it, and I wrote a book review of it, and I gave it to Eddie for the paper. But it was how LBJ killed JFK. Mm. And I don't believe he did, although after reading the book, did I tell you this? After reading the book, I think it would have been possible because Johnson had had friends in Texas who had, it appeared, killed people, enemies of his that needed to be eliminated. And he was absolutely ruthless. And so anyhow, well, I thought the book was important to show you what Johnson was like. So that's why I wrote the review. But in it, I recounted, which I'm going to tell you now, an experience I still remember that I had in one of these conventions. One of these farmers came up to me and he said, "You know, lady, politics is no Sunday school picnic," he was telling me. And I said to him, "Well, the closer we get to that Sunday school picnic, the better off the politics are going to be." So it was always this little feeling of the game, because there are people that like the game. It's just this stupid game that they're playing of putting one person against the other. And it was in spite of the game that I was there. I never did like the game. I still don't like the game.
But you really believed in what you were doing back then.
I did believe that it was a way, I actually believed that it was a way to get peace. I believed that by being involved in the party, that I could have some power at that level, uh-huh. and that my power could be expressed and do something good. And that was false, absolutely false. Because the party, when the Vietnam War came, and I tried to do something, I came up here to a meeting, they practically laughed at me. The decision was made on top. I didn't have, and that's when I got mad at Humphrey, we never spoke again. And I wrote him a letter and asked him why his sons weren't in the war. And he answered the letter, but he didn't answer that part of it. And I told him that the farmers that he knew and I knew, one of those, the sons of one of those farmers was in the Vietnam War and was killed. And I said, Woody Piper's son is dead. And why haven't your sons been in the war? So we didn't, and that was the end of it. But politics, it should be, Mike. That's the system that's set up.
Right.
It should be, but it's too personal. It is not the way it should be. We should be able to disagree, but it doesn't work. And the Democrats are, you can see what's happening to them. They're playing the game, and they're just less honest than the Republicans. Less honest.
Only by a little.
Yeah. Well, I say this though. The Republicans say, this is what we believe in, and this is what we're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I say less honest.
Yeah.
So, anyhow.
So, when you were in the Democratic Party in Wyndham, you met Hubert Humphrey?
Yeah.
Several times?
Many times.
Many times.
Many
times. Developed a friendship?
Yes, we were friends, and I liked him.
You came up to Minneapolis for a convention or something? And
I would see him. I never was at his house, but I knew his wife. I knew Muriel. I knew Orville Freeman. I knew Jane Freeman. I knew Karl Rovog, who was a governor. I knew Florence Rovog. We were all friends. I was at the Democratic Convention, two of them, I'm trying to remember. One was the one in Chicago, but I was at another Democratic Convention. And so we knew each other, and I did a good job, and they knew it. And I was competent. And so that was, you know.
Okay, so back to our story, the judgeship came open.
Yeah.
And you heard about it?
Yeah, I heard about it.
And you made a phone call?
Absolutely, I made several. I was pretty much a pass, I think.
And Walter was all for it, obviously.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
And somewhere in the next weeks here, we're going to hit some stuff that's going to be a little difficult to talk about. I don't think this will be this question.
What do you mean?
Well, just, you know, as we get into some of the issues that have developed, or Melinda and so forth. But so there was a decision made to move to Marshall and accept the judgeship.
Yeah.
How was that, or was it even discussed with Barbara or Connie or Melinda?
Oh, no.
It was just done, and one day you said, well, we're moving.
Well, of course, it took a period of time, and we talked about it over this possibility before it happened.
Okay.
So I don't
think. Around the dinner table or something.
Yeah, and they knew there was a. Well, I don't think anybody. I don't know. I don't believe that anybody cared, but I don't remember. I don't remember that they did.
Sure. So, let's see. Walter moved first, didn't he?
He did. He was there for several months before I came. Then we found a house, and we had this terrible problem. We couldn't sell our house, and we bought another house, and getting rid of those, then the money was just, but we finally managed.
And I went with Marcella from Wyndham to Marshall, and she was driving, and the car went in the ditch.
Oh, yeah, it could have happened.
Yeah, I think so. Doesn't ring any bells, though.
No.
Okay.
And we haven't talked about Marcella, which we should.
Yeah. Well, let's touch on it. Marcella came to visit in Wyndham.
Marcella came every summer.
Every summer?
Marcella came every summer. And Marcella, Marcella was very difficult. Was very difficult. And resentful and critical and a pain in the neck. She was not a pain in the neck when our friends were concerned. She was judgmental? But I'll give you examples. She wanted the meals, you know, I've always been kind of this way and that way about, she wanted the meals served at noon. And she wanted, and my housekeeping didn't meet her standards. And what else can I tell you? She was the bane of my existence, and I could not understand what she got out of coming. And she simply announced, I never invited her, ever. She wrote and said she was coming. And she would make comments about me to the children, to you all. Mm. And I knew it. And Walter, it was so bad. And we failed miserably. We failed her miserably. Mike, we should have confronted her. We should have gone to a psychologist. We should have had somebody in there and said, this has got to stop. We like you. Walter loved her. We've got to come to some, but I put up with it. When you just put up with something, it's no good. I put up with it, mm-hmm. And by the end of the summer, I just be at wit's end wanting her to go, mm-hmm. Just wanting her to leave. She was always, and she was so lonely. Mm-hmm. She was so lonely.
Yeah.
So terribly lonely.
Yeah.
And I don't know what happened to Marcella. I've seen pictures of her. I've got some here. It makes you want to cry because she looked so happy when she was in college and she was with her friends.
Right.
And she was sexually, I don't know what it was, but I don't think she could give herself to anybody.
Well, she met somebody in high school, as I recall.
Yes, that she really liked.
And then it didn't work out.
But I don't know what happened.
Right.
And then she went to school in South Dakota where she went home every weekend, which was probably wrong. And she fought with her mother terribly, just terrible fights with her mother. Hmm. And then when Walter's dad married, then you know, I think I told you that one Christmas, she was and Walter were home with Lou and Walter. And they got in this terrible battle, and she walked out.
I remember reading some letters. I don't know if you gave them to me. I must have read them no more than a year or two ago. About they were written by Walter's mother, I believe, about Marcella.
Yeah,
and it was something was going on because she said, "I just don't know what I'm going to do."
I know.
And she, I think she said something like she stays in her room and cries. And
well, you know, she could have been depressed.
Yeah.
She probably was terribly depressed. If I had said to Walter, you've got to, he could have done it, I think, mm-hmm. If he would have, you've got to take her aside and say to her, this isn't fair to you. I couldn't excuse me, I get very nervous. It's water under the dam, but it's so funny that you try to, now you talk about being inconsistent. If you're trying to work for a peaceful world and somebody's right under your nose, mm-hmm. That is so unhappy, mm-hmm. And you don't do anything forceful about it. You just, I was just putting up with it. And you shouldn't just put up with anything.
Right.
So anyhow, that was sad.
So So you moved to Marshall with some trepidation, some anticipation. What was your emotion?
Well, Marshall was known as a really mean town before we ever got there.
It was.
Uh-huh, it was, and we were told that.
Really?
Yeah, that it was a mean town. And, you
well,
know...
How can a whole town be mean, but, you know...
Well, this was on the basis of people who lived there who had had difficulties, and let me see if I can tell you who it was. Well, it was through a case or two that Walter had heard about. And so when I say a town is mean, I will say the people, the elite in the town.
Mm-hmm. The movers and shakers.
They were. They thought that they were important. And in Wyndham's a nice little town, you know. You didn't have that. Nobody was that important. But in Marshall, there was this kind of elite. And when we moved there, we naturally were considered part of that elite.
Okay.
But we never made it. And we did to some degree. But Walter played golf with the people.
Right.
But I didn't like them, and they didn't like me. They did not like me. And it isn't that I probably didn't like them from the beginning. When I say them, it was the people that were the wives of the lawyers and the doctors and the people that had money and the people that went to the country club. And I think I told you that we said we were part of a dancing club. Was it a dancing club or a supper club or something? Met once a month. That was composed of these people. And it was okay, and they were okay. And there were some people that still I did have good friends there. But the thing that I got out of that group with, just like I got out of a group in Wyndham, I went one evening. We were at this at the golf club, and Walter had had a case in which he came home, and he said, "You know, I had to do something terrible today. I had to send a man to jail," and he said for stealing tires, and he said he had four kids, and he said he didn't have much education, and he wasn't real bright, and he said he couldn't provide for his children. They were hungry, and he stole tires, and he said, according to the law, I had to send him to prison. And he was upset. He was blue about it. And so I mentioned this to these people sitting there. And the other part that your father said, I couldn't. He said, what do we do about something like that? Who would I be to, how could the society tell a man, you're not bright enough, or you're not smart enough to have children, to deny him that right? How are you gonna? So I said that, and the doctor said, who was my friend, you know, boy, if you left that decision up to me, I surely could do it. And the attitude at that table over that comment was so bad that I said to Walter, I never want to go again. And we didn't. I
remember the meanness.
Oh, yeah. That was the end. But now there were still people there that I liked. And Irv Wiltrout just died not too long ago, one of the lawyers. And I heard about it, and I called her, Verva, who was a good friend, and I'll go down and see her. And then the Motors, and occasionally I'll hear from somebody up here that I was friends with there, because they're always good people. But the newspaper was mean, it was kind of the resentment. And also I read something about a study one time. And it said that if you have a position in a society and you choose to not live up to what the position calls for, there's real resentment. So that was my position.
You're choosing to play their game.
Exactly. Then there is real resentment. And that was me, see, because I was not I was not going to live up to what they thought a judge's wife should be. I never was. And I remember being in the house one time when there was a fire someplace and the fireman was outside. I do remember this. And they said they'd like to spray our house. I'd really like to turn it on that house right there. And I don't know why, who those firemen were, but it was during the Vietnam era when I'd been pretty vocal. Okay.
So you, so who found the house in Marshall? Did you go first and find it, or?
I don't know. It was owned by a veterinarian, mm-hmm. and it was, I don't know, it was not in the neighborhood where you would have thought we would have lived,
right.
because it was right, I don't know, but I liked it. It was just that, and I liked it being where it was, so we bought it.
So I think I asked you this question, I'm not sure if you answered. When you were talking about moving to Marshall, and then you, just as you were moving, your anticipation, excitement, what was going on with you, or did it not matter? Or, I mean, do you recall thinking, boy, this is going to be great, now our lives are going to be perfect?
Well, I know, I was just glad for your father, because I thought it would provide him with more satisfaction and than he had had in practicing law, and
you
it
were,
did.
You were happy in Wyndham.
I was happier in Wyndham, yeah. It was.
No,
yeah.
But I mean, you were satisfied if you'd stayed in Wyndham. You had no desire to move.
To stay in Wyndham? No, I didn't want to live in. Wyndham's a small town. I really didn't. It was not my idea of a good place to live.
Marshall wasn't that much bigger. I mean.
No, that's true. But it did. It was a more an assured income, and Walter would feel good about it. I knew he would feel good about what he could accomplish. And
so you recall your first either very positive or very negative or just your first memory of Marshall driving into town for the first time, or maybe it was the third week you were there, some incident or something. The newspaper had a photograph of the family.
Oh, yes. And I remember I met the Hawks, and I met Marcy and Paul, and I really liked them, and they were really, it was wonderful to meet her. And she had seen my picture in the paper, and she had wanted to meet me, because she was kind of like I was. We were both like kind of fish out of water. And so it was, that was really good. So I liked that. When I went, one thing, I couldn't be active in politics anymore.
I was just going to ask about that.
Because they had an unwritten, or maybe it was even written rule, that judges' wives could not participate in politics. So I got active in the UN Association, and it was kind of my outlet, but I did that. And
I remember collecting money for UNICEF.
Yeah, right.
Is that at Halloween or no?
Yeah, it is Halloween, right. And what else? But I think there was, you asked me about resentment in Wyndham. I think there was resentment about me and Marshall, and I'm not quite sure. I think it was because I really didn't want to play the games.
And when did you meet Madam Smith?
I don't remember exactly. But she loved me, and she was a godsend because she was just such a, and then you talk about a renegade, such a total renegade, and so I enjoyed her.
And how did she ever end up in Marshall, I wonder? I mean, she was a seamstress?
She was Icelandic, actually, and she wasn't, but her family came from Iceland. And they came from, I think, now that would have been an interesting story. She married a man. I don't think she was married to him more than a month. And had Bob, her son. And that was the end of it. Then she once had an affair with some doctor that lived someplace else. And that was all I know about her sex life. But... What a character.
I remember her apartment over the drugstore. We'd go up there and...
And you know, she was, Mike, she was not always loyal to me. She would talk about me, something terrible, to other people. And it's funny. I knew that about her, but it didn't really matter. It was just Madam.
And what other positive people or events in your first years in Marshall? What
other one? Well, we did meet some nice people in Ivanhoe that are still friends. Not, I don't ever see them, but...
Judges or...?
No, lawyers.
Okay.
And there were some lawyers throughout the county there that made it a point to invite us and over to meet with them. And I remember going there, and then we were in a little town of Cottonwood. There was a banker there that asked us over. And we were there one time when Mondale came down, and I knew Walter Mondale too. And I remember the Vietnam War was on. Something was happening because I mentioned, I talked to him about it. And Walter reminded me of it. And he said to me, if you knew what I knew, you wouldn't be asking me these questions. That was his answer to me.
Never explain himself.
No. So I can't think of anything more to tell you about Marshall. The school system was, I did not like the school system.
Right.
I did not like the principal, Olson. No, not Olson. That was the Lord Mayor. I've forgotten his name.
But Dan Prune?
No, I didn't like him either.
No.
But there was a principal.
There's another one.
Yeah.
Randall? No, he was a teacher.
Yeah, all those bad teachers, I know. But anyhow. Then there were good friends there, the Paul and Judy Plank.
Mm-hmm.
And she got in touch with me. She was a Quaker. And so we became very good friends. And so then we had then the Tesdales, and then Margaret was a friend. And we had a little group called the Committee of Concern, which was... Margaret and Judy Plank and I think that was just the three of us, and we'd get together and write letters to the editor and things like that.
I was going to ask you, either in Wyndham or in Marshall, did you ever go to Walter's court when it was in session?
I think I went once or twice. Isn't that funny? When my mother and my Aunt Bug came there one time, and they went to the courtroom, and I think Aunt Bug pulled out a newspaper or something, and Walter said, you can't do that. But anyhow, they were in the courtroom. And I think I was once in his courtroom, but I don't know why I never went. I just didn't go.
And so you moved to Marshall, and then I think we hadn't been there, I don't know how long we'd been there before you remodeled the family room, where you did something.
Oh yeah, we did that almost immediately.
Almost immediately. And and you stopped all connection to the Democratic Party.